Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Before we begin, let's hear a quick message from our sponsor.
Hello, HR. It's me, your HR data. And I need to apologize. I'm sorry for being all over the place. I'm sorry for being difficult. I'm sorry for not being there for you. But it's not my fault. You put me in different HR systems and messy spreadsheets. But guess what? I now have a new friend, and their name is Employee Cycle. They can put all of me in one HR dashboard for you and keep me updated and simple so we'll better understand each other. Look, we're smarter when we're working together, so if you want me to show you my full potential, please go to employeecycle.com to get your free demo today. That's employeecycle.com. Promise me you'll go. Our relationship depends on it.
Hello, and welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host for today, Bruce Marable, CEO and co-founder of the HR dashboard company Employee Cycle. And today we're going to talk about what does HR look like in the year 2030? So let me introduce our special guest for this episode, SVP of Talent, Engagement, and Inclusion at the 4A's, which is the American Association of Advertising Agencies. Give it up for Keisha Jean-Baptiste. Woo!
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, world, and hello, Bruce.
So, just want to let the world know that this is Keisha's first podcast. So, we are so happy to be your first podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited as well.
Great. So, before we go into the topic, as we ask all of our guests, can you please let us know how you ended up in the wonderful world of HR?
Oh my gosh, that's a great starting question, and that's a good story, actually. I started my career full of passion and eyes, you know, bright, wide open, thinking that I would be a marketer. I wanted to work in strategy at an advertising agency, and I thought that that was my path, my forever path. And I spent the first 7 years of my career being in that role at various agencies and as well as at a magazine. And about 7 years into my career, I had this itch and I couldn't figure out what was wrong. And, you know, it was like I was progressing in my career, getting lots of accolades. And honestly, I was fairly successful in the job, but I didn't have that internal sense of satisfaction. I always felt like I was chasing something. And so I reached out to my mentor, who's a woman by the name of Judy Jackson, who happened to be the head of HR for multiple companies that I'd worked at that point. And she said to me, she was like, you know, you really need to be in HR. I thought she was crazy. She'd shared it with me before, and I'm like, no, that's not me. And actually, you know, I really didn't know, but I didn't know what they, I only knew what Judy did. I really didn't understand HR. And so I thought she was crazy, quote unquote, in the sense that, you know, I couldn't see the how I would relate to that field. And I just had no clue what the job was about. So I remember going home at this particular time when, you know, in 2005, when she nudged me, and I talked to my husband about it, and it was like this immediate response he had, which was like, of course you should do that. I'm like, what do you guys see that I don't see? And so I spent the weekend thinking about it, and I finally said, all right, you know what? I'm going to listen. I'm going to give in. And I had the opportunity to go back to an agency that I had pretty much built my career in the marketing side at that agency. I had an opportunity to go back and cover someone's maternity leave who was on the talent team. So it was one of those, you know, risk-free situations. You know, it was cover this maternity leave. If you like the new role and the career change in talent, you're good to go. If you don't, you can go back to the marketing role that you are in. And so it was a win-win, you know? And I remember the very first week that when I started that role, I was initially like, okay, so what do we do? Where are the projects? Where's the work? How does this work? You know, I was used to managing campaigns and teams and, you know, all that stuff. And so once I figured out the how you engaged and that the people just come and issues and problems show up, by the end of that week, I had the most amazing feeling, which was the very first time I experienced work satisfaction. I went home on a Friday night on a high, and I've never looked back.
Wow, that is a great story. So can you tell us a little bit about what you do and what does your organization do?
Okay, so let's start with my organization. So we are a 100-year-old trade organization. And the reason for being, the purpose of the organization I'm with, the 4A's, is that we are here to support and guide and advocate for agencies. The evolution of my industry is really quite interesting over a 100-year period. But primarily, it started out as advertising agencies that were fairly one-dimensional in terms of the set of services they provide. And in this day and age, you know, even using the term agency doesn't quite describe the kind of work that's being done. But really, really at its core, at our core, we are here to advocate, support, advance, and lead in the space where our clients, I'm sorry, our member agencies are doing marketing, communications, advertising, PR, sort of that whole gamut of work in service to client brands. And the way that we're organized is that we have practice leads. And so if you think of it a little bit as a consultant model, a consultancy model, we have agencies, you know, I'll just have to use that word, that are members of our organization, and they get a set of services. It's a fee-based organization, so they pay an annual fee, and they get a set of services, support, and thought leadership from us. We also advise kind of more broadly on the industry itself, but when you're a member agency, you get a deeper level of services. So I'm the practice lead for talent engagement as well as diversity and inclusion. And I say those two separately, but really it's an integrated way that I look at it. And my role at this point, I mean, I'm still evolving in it. I just started at the organization in September. Prior to being with the 4A's, I was the head of HR and talent for Wieden Kennedy out of Portland, Oregon, so their headquarters. I was there for about 6 years. Before that, I was the head of HR for Digitas out of their New York office. And I also supported the Connecticut office. So I'm used to being that person who is creating employee experiences, figuring out how to engage, you know, the employee population, looking at the opportunities around, you know, culture initiatives and really connecting talent strategy to business. I'm also used to being, you know, that person in house who was there for employee relations and, you know, mediating and facilitating through conflict, team casting, looking at leadership bench and development opportunities to stretch our leaders. And so this role for me now with the association is one where I have an opportunity to impact change across the industry. I have an opportunity to kind of look broadly at a set of talent issues and a set of business issues and sort of this evolution that businesses are going through right now and provide some guidance and quite frankly, solutions on an organizational level. So I'm really, it's surprising to me that I made this switch, to be honest with you, because I'm a person who really thrives off of being surrounded by absorbing the culture I'm working in. And so in this role, I get to go in and out of multiple agencies and experience their culture, experience their challenges, understand the people who are working there and who are leading. But the great thing is I'm able to look, you know, at the 30,000 foot level and say, okay, agency over here has this, you know, these challenges. How are they connected to these agencies over here? And what are the common elements? And can I provide a solution that might, you know, that may help in both cases. And so it's a broad role. I'm still totally wrapping my head around it, to be honest. It's like 7 months in, but I'm jazzed and I'm thrilled to bring all of my experience together in this capacity.
So to bring it full circle back to the title of what does HR look like in the year 2030, you actually put on a conference titled Talent at 2030. So can you tell us a little bit about that? What are the goals and why was this invented?
Great question. So why this was invented, and I have to give credit to my predecessor, Singleton Beto. This conference was created in 2014. And really, the premise at that time, as I understand it, was to bring the community of HR and talent leaders in my industry together to be in one conversation about talent challenges, opportunities, and really sharing best practices and elevating the conversation so that there can be, I think, a community around advancing and driving change. And so the conference, again, started in 2014. It's an annual conference. And the driver, I think, around the name as well was, you know, let's look forward. Let's plan, let's get ahead. There are a lot of changes that are going on demographically in this country. There are a lot of changes in terms of workplace, the workplace itself, expectations that the workforce has of a work environment, and the types of business challenges that at least in my industry, we were faced with at that time. And so I'm thrilled to have inherited this conference. I have been a attendee of the conference, a speaker at the conference, and I found the environment to be empowering and inspiring. I've gone to other HR conferences, and you know, there are times where some of the conversation is just super tactical. And when you're at a senior level, the issues that you know you need to talk about are really around business strategy, talent strategy, and things that are much more elevated. And so what I found is that this conference delivers on that, and the emphasis on the future really is just that. You know, I think often in HR we talk about best practices, but best practices inherently assume that the practice that one company has should be imitated and followed. And I think, or at least my point of view around that is, I honestly do not like the phrase best practices. I think in this day and age, and what I can foresee in the future, particularly around HR, is that we are being driven to evolve. We are, I think, as a practice, we are lagging in our own evolution in terms of being much more out in front, business oriented, as well as staying sort of true to the human experience and sort of the core of why the words human and resources have come together. And so I see HR evolving in so many ways. And one primary way that I see it evolving is to get back in touch with that human element. And human-centered HR approaches, not to be redundant with my words, but people-centered, I can say it that way, people-centered HR approaches, I think, are going to, it's going to be the cornerstone of our evolution as an industry and as a practice.
Before we talk about where HR is going to in 2030, let's talk about where HR is today. So where do you think most agencies are today in regards to HR being a practice or strategic function of the business?
That's a good question. I you know, a lot of it comes down to, I would say this is true of any organization, not just in my industry. I think that you have multiple camps, and a lot of it is driven by leadership and sort of the culture of a company and what the company values. And so I'll speak in the two camps that I'm most familiar with, as well as, honestly, I've worked in both of those environments. The one side of HR, you know, depending on who you report to, this is really where you see HR's orientation. There's one side of HR that is still very, very much embedded in operations. And in some cases, you'll see HR reporting into a COO or a CFO, and the operations are about the engine of running a company. And so, very transactional. very much a sort of process-driven, in and out way of interacting with people, and where HR is engaged primarily to assure that things go well, go right, are above the law, by the law, compliance-driven, sort of in that way. And there are a number of specialties within HR that are necessary, and that where their roles really are that day-to-day. And I'm saying that to say payroll is that way day-to-day. Benefits is, generally speaking, that way day-to-day, although I think there's much more advancement in terms of benefits evolving to wellness and wellness strategies, taking over. So you have that camp where HR is operational. The other side is where, and there are a number of agencies that have this model, which is where HR is a strategic business partner, where HR is embedded in business decisions, and not just as an outcome of a decision being made and passed through, but really as a business partner in making the decisions. And I mean everything from what business an agency is going after, the implications of that business on the culture and the talent and leadership bench. I know in many cases, if you have the right oriented HR lead or chief talent officer, those individuals are consulted on mergers and acquisitions. They're consulted on client relationships. They're consulted on RFPs, and that's the role that I think in our, biggest aim as a field, that's a role that I see HR playing at its best. And those organizations, if you were to look at the org chart side by side of an operationally oriented HR team and a strategically focused embedded business partner, sort of an HR model, you will see a different range of titles, different range of skill sets, and a different sort of team structure and makeup. And my hope is that we evolve, particularly in my industry, more toward that embedded model.
You just said that HR a lot of the times reports to COOs and CFOs. So do you think those are the appropriate executives that they should be reporting to? Do you think that HR should report directly to the president or CEO? Can you give some thoughts around that?
Absolutely. I do not think that HR should report to COOs or CFOs. And the reason is because the values, the sort of focus of what HR can be at its fullest and its most, in terms of being able to maximize the abilities and the strategic alignment of what HR is meant to do, I think it can get lost, and it often gets lost when you're reporting to a COO and CFO. And I'm not saying this as a personal sort of affront on anyone who's in that role. It's just that the orientation is very different. And I believe that's, you get into more operationally based decisioning, you get into decisions that are about financials, efficiency, things that sort of dismiss the human element, and also dismiss if I think about it from a talent standpoint, and I mean that to say skill sets, that sort of dismiss the leveraging of those skill sets in the most appropriate ways. And at times, there are things, decisions that have to be made around talent that will not make financial sense in the beginning. And sometimes programming and investments that you need to make may not initially make good financial sense, but the return pays out, later. So I believe that HR should only be reporting to the top. I think that the practice of talent management is one that CEOs own. And also have to drive, and it has to be a core value from a CEO or president perspective, because culture is driven from the top. And I think that the only way that you can really ensure that HR is being leveraged as a strategically generated capability is when HR reports to the CEO.
So from your own personal career, and from you being a part of the broader HR community outside of the agency landscape, what do you think is different for HR in an agency? Or is HR in an agency different? And if so, how?
Oh, I've never thought about it that way to full extent. It's different in a lot of ways. One is that agencies are all about creativity and innovation, and there's a constant constant activity. there's just work happening all the time. And the energy of the of an agency environment, I think, is different from the corporate side. That's sort of how we refer to it, the client side, let's say. And you know, because we are, it's sort of, you know, you have some agencies that are much more creatively driven. You have agencies that might be more into digital or into strategy. But at the end of the day, you generally, the type of people that work in agencies are fairly unique. They're makers, they're creators, they're dreamers. You do have a lot of type A personalities, and you do have those who are pragmatic and practical, but for the most part, the heartbeat of an agency, particularly one that is in the business of creating lots of work and making lots of work, you know, the energy is very different. Also, agency environments tend to revolve around culture. You know, I mean that in the broadest sense of society. And so there's a constant sort of what's happening today, what's it now. And so that energy and buzz, I do think, is pretty different. So when it comes to practicing HR, you know, you have a set of laws, employee laws and things that are in place, and compliance, all that stuff is in place. But we tend to be generally, as an industry, one that wants to support people having that freedom to create and be inventive. And so the way that you practice HR in the industry I'm in, I firmly believe, has to be one that's not about policing. And one that's really about developing talent and really understanding how to allow talent to flourish in an environment so they can do their best work. And some industries are really oriented in more of a compliance-driven HR practice. And not to say that's wrong or anything, there are sometimes unions that guide that as well, but we don't have that in my industry. And I think that allows us, or at least there's an opportunity for us to really focus on the talent management aspect, the organizational culture aspect, the leadership and talent development aspect, and less on compliance, to be honest.
I can personally relate to what you were saying in regards to agencies having strong culture and a lot of the HR role being about culture. Although I wasn't in HR, my first job out of school was at an agency called Tierney, and then after that, I worked at Razorfish, and they both had, although different, very strong culture. So I could definitely personally relate to that. In regards to HR in agencies, again, I want to dig a little deeper into that. Are there any things that have happened or any paradigm shifts in the agency landscape that has happened over the past few years to really impact HR and how HR works as a function?
Yeah, and I can't, you know, to not bring this up in this day and age and with the current climate around sexual harassment would be a mistake. So I need to speak to that. It's not the only thing I would say that has happened over the last couple of years, but it is absolutely the thing that I wake up thinking about and go to bed thinking about, which is, you know, generally, the industry over the last 40, 50 years has had a very strong emphasis and drive toward diversifying. And the company I work for, the 4As, we have a program called the Multicultural Advertising Intern Program. It's been around for 45 years, and it's the longest running organization of its kind. And, you know, many of our agencies, honestly, they were created and led by white men, and we have seen a change over the last probably 20 some odd years, where you have multicultural agencies, you know, of all types, you have women-led agencies in the last 10 years that have come up even more so. But what's challenging for our industry, as much as we've had this emphasis and push and drive toward diversifying and and looking for people of color, women, and bringing that type of talent in, integrating that talent, in agencies, what we struggle with is when there's a misalignment with the culture. And, because our industry was sort of born out of, and it's just like tech, where you have mostly men in terms of the legacy of advertising, mostly men who've been in the business, there's a climate change that's happening because the power structures, status, hierarchy, and honestly privilege have driven a certain type of behavior and way of socializing and interacting that have made people who are already marginalized even more so. And so so we struggle with that as an industry, just like many other industries. We have a number of agencies who are on the right side of change, and they have been for so long. But, you can do whatever, at an organizational level with policies and programs, you can have all that stuff in place, training and all that in place. All it takes is one person, right? One person with bad behaviors, who knows they can get away with it, and maybe who's, taking advantage of their own power and privilege and abusing that power to create the wrong environment, And so what we're seeing with the Me Too movement more broadly in society is something that is impacting our industry quite a bit. We've had a number of leaders across agencies terminated in the last few months because of allegations that I'm assuming have proven to be true, and it's led to termination. It may not have been proven. In some cases, some individuals may have just decided to leave on their own. But the fact of the matter is that there's no tolerance anymore for that behavior. I think that mostly women right now who are speaking up around sexual harassment, it's a great thing to see that silence is being broken. At the same time, I know that that also creates a backlash in terms of fear, from men who don't necessarily know how to operate right now. And I'm not saying that because I'm excusing bad behavior, but I think that we have to relearn how to engage at work. And we need to relearn as society things that are acceptable and not acceptable, because there are politicians, there are celebrities, there are business leaders, men who are being called out for behavior that has been around for 20 some odd years. So all along the way, there are a number of people who've been complicit in accepting that environment. And I think right now, the biggest thing that we're seeing in HR is there's a lack of trust because there's no transparency in what happens when you report. There's a lack of trust because in the case where, and this is where the conflict is, when HR reports to the head, the CEO and the president, and as I said, I do believe that that's the right model. But at the end of the day, when you have issues like this, in terms of harassment and discrimination, you have a conflict. Is that leader at the top going to do anything about it? And HR can often be compromised in the sense of, escalating and elevating a situation to the person at the top who says, here's what I want you to do and here's what I don't want you to do. So we have challenges with that. And I think I think the evolution of HR is going to mean that there is much more discipline in how we handle investigations with harassment and discrimination specifically. There's going to need to be more preventative measures taken when bullying shows up and when intimidation shows up. We have to look at behaviors early and notice what those, notice the triggers, notice the signals early, because usually it starts with those types of behaviors and escalates to harassment and discrimination. and we have to operate in a way that allows for confidentiality and integrity to be maintained. And I believe that means that HR has to be removed from that equation, and you have to utilize a third party when things like, you know, a real claim of harassment and discrimination come up.
Wow, that was a lot. And I have so many, and I have so many questions about that are not on my interview list. The first is, wow, having been in the HR tech space and been selling to a lot of HR professionals over the year, I know, and this is no shocker, that a lot of the professionals are women. And so when we talk about sexual harassment and other types of harassment, specifically when it comes to a man harassing a woman, how does HR deal with that as the woman who is being harassed? If you are HR, who do you tell?
Wait, if I'm the one being harassed?
Yeah, so if the HR person, if the HR executive or leader is the one being harassed and that HR leader is a woman, who does that person tell? And I've never thought about that before until just when you were talking about harassment.
You know, this question is a big one. and I have to give some context here. So many, you know, HR is female, and there are a number of female heads of HR, chief talent officers, that report into men. I am aware of some who have been in situations where they were harassed or sort of where there has been some sort of sexual advance. I'm very aware of that. I'm also very aware of some situations where there's been other forms of discrimination toward the head person in HR based on either race or age even. The challenge is, in my industry, we have some agencies that are independent. And so what you should do in terms of outreach is, in that case, if you are the person that's being harassed, if you're at a publicly held company, you should report it to the board of directors, because that CEO usually does report into the above. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot at risk if you are the HR person who's reporting the CEO or president of an organization. There's a lot of risk, and you have to be incredibly brave and understand. And I understand that people are fearful of this, right, of approaching it. And so at times they stay silent. Now, if you're at a private company, an independent company, that's where things get really tricky. And I, you know, my advice to people in those situations would be to seek outside counsel. And the outside counsel should not be the law firm that your agency and company works with. Outside counsel should be someone that you find on your own that can represent you, that can hear you without bias, and could give some advisement on how to handle the situation.
Got it. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
And it definitely was not under our topic, but it's a very important topic. And so for all of our listeners who are listening, especially the women, I think that was great advice and information for them. So in regards to the amount of influence or power that an HR leader has, just in general, in comparison to those HR professionals and agencies, do you think that's different? Or from my experience, again, having, you know, sold to a lot of HR professionals, it seems that the more white collar the position, or the more white collar positions that the organization has, the more corporate the organization is, and the more reliant the business is on people. So meaning that the people are the business.
Yeah.
So not retail or grocery where you're actually buying items, but consulting or doing something where the people are providing the service, it seems that HR might have an upper leg or might have more influence because managing, retaining, and training talent might be more important. But have you found that true as well?
I have found that true, and it's exactly for the reason you said. I think I also think that there's a big difference. And I, you know, corporate or client side is kind of the way that we distinguish our business from our industry from others. There's also a big difference in investment and infrastructure that those types of companies have that that we don't really have the benefit of in our industry. We are a service, a client service industry. And so most of our infrastructure, honestly, and the resources, and I mean that from a financial standpoint, as well as sort of headcount, go toward delivering solutions for clients. And there is a shift, and I don't know if I addressed this earlier well enough, but there is a shift with the agencies that are larger, multinational, and public, quite frankly, where their HR organizations are much more mature, and they see and understand that what makes good business is a talent strategy that is integrated and aligned with their business strategy. And that's pretty much what you're talking about when you gave reference to, you know, to those types of companies. And, you know, we have some agencies that are really small. And we have agencies, and they're in startup mode, you know, and then we have agencies that have been around for over 100 years, you know, and those are the ones I think that generally have reached that point where they see that, you know, their power, their success is really rooted in the people and the talent and the skill set that those individuals bring to the table, you know. And in my business, because we don't necessarily sell, I mean, we sell ideas, you know, we don't make widgets, you know, and so the ideas come from people. And so the environment in which we have to create around the talent being able to flourish, thrive, ideate, innovate, you know, and sort of have that freedom, it's so important. So I am seeing the shift in that way, in dollars that are given to HR teams in order to support a fully integrated talent practice.
And then last question about the present before we go into the future. Mm-hmm. You referenced earlier that it seems that agencies and tech companies are going through a lot of the same issues, which I can also personally relate to because my entire career has been either in the agency space or the tech space. And they almost seem to be the same. I know a lot of people that bounce back and forth as career options. So I am curious, as the organization that represents all of the advertising agencies across the country, have you considered broadening the scope of your conference, your mission, your organization to also include tech? And I don't know if this would be more of a rebranding more so than just including the broader tech space, because it's almost the same, or at least to me on the outside looking in, a lot of the skill sets are the same from a marketing, web, technology standpoint. And a lot of the marketing agencies are either, or agencies in general, are building technology or using the technology of the software companies. And it seems to be this very incestuous community where it's almost indistinguishable at this point. So I'm curious as to what that looks like. And I guess this kind of does go into the future. What does that look like as a silo versus broadening and being more inclusive of the tech community as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right about it from a talent standpoint. We share talent. And in fact, I think the emergence of those companies like the Facebook, Googles, Twitters, as well as just generally tech startups, have created, I think, a level of competition for my industry. And this is something that's not new. It's probably been around for about 20 years now with the emergence of digital overall, and particularly with the emergence, I think, of social, you know, with Instagram and Snapchat and such. And so what's interesting is that from a business standpoint, we are all in the same ecosystem. You know, tech providers, tech companies, tech providers, vendors, you know, production companies as well. We are working together in some capacity, and in some cases, really partnering on behalf of the same brand. But there is a difference in the. I believe there's a difference in the type of person who wants to work in an agency and the type of person who wants to work for a tech company. And some of it does come down to skill set. So if someone's a hardcore coder and really wants to create large-scale technical solutions, and in some cases, a little bit more infrastructure, you know, on the infrastructure level. I mean, you know, you don't find a lot of agencies who are doing that kind of work. We tend to partner out, maybe hire a production company, but we work with outside partners. And so our distinction really is because we're not, there are some agencies that create products. RGA is probably one of them. Sapient is another one. Sapient Razorfish, excuse me. But we are still very distinct and different than what a Facebook may do or Google may do. And so at the end of the day, we do share a similar talent pool. We have talent that's coming in and out, particularly when you have in-house agencies being created at some of these brands. And I think that's the place that we find ourselves in terms of, you know, competition. In my view, as someone who, you know, is looking at this again at the 30,000 foot level, I actually think that makes our industry stronger if people were to round out and get those experiences and bring it back. I think that I love to look at when I think about talent that I would, you know, if I were in a position of hiring, you know, I would be, if I was still in an agency, I mean, and I was hiring, I would love to see people who have that level of experience on both sides, you know, working in-house at a creative shop at Facebook, working in an agency, a variety of different agencies. I think that when you're able to see the problem and solution from multiple aspects, it makes you a stronger leader, you know, and it makes you a stronger asset, honestly, as a leader in our industry. So we do have people that, you know, that bounce out, you know, at the mid-level, and some who come back. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that what we have to do as an industry is get back to the point where our value proposition is clear. The distinctions and the career paths within an agency are clear, because I think what's gone on in the last few years, and maybe this is longer than just a few, it may be 10 years, is that value proposition has gotten a bit murky. And it's hard, particularly for people who are at the mid-level, to see what the differences are. But I'm pretty clear on those differences. And I think those who have spent time on both sides understand the difference as well. And again, there's a certain type of personality, you know, I think for someone who's interested in and attracted to working in an agency.
Great. So now let's go into the future. Your conference and the title of this podcast is, what does HR look like in the year 2030? So the first thing that I wanted to know is, why the year 2030?
Well, you know, when the conference was established, that was the conference was established and sort of concepted in 2013. So 2030 really was about, I guess at that point, what, you know, 15 or so years away. And it's a marker for the future. And, you know, I was saying this earlier, but what that year is tied to is primarily, quite frankly, this demographic shift. So I don't know if you've heard the term majority-minority, but there are all, yep. We've seen for years the census projections on how the demographics in the U.S. are going to change. And there was a point in time where I think that projection of becoming a majority-minority country, it was initially, it might have been around 2040, years ago, they may have projected it at 2040. And it's actually happening faster. And so by the year 2030, we are going to be in that, we're going to be living in that reality where we are a majority minority country. And we want, you know, and if you think about where advertising has its main hubs in the cities in which we have the largest presence, New York, LA, Chicago, San Francisco, you know, you see the demographic shift already. You see it in the school systems today. And school systems are trying to catch up to that in terms of what they teach, how they teach, and the teaching staff and faculty. And so it's coming. And so that's kind of where, just to give you the context, that's really what the basis of that is the majority minority state. The other thing is around technology. and the evolution of technology. And we are seeing this more and more today with artificial intelligence. And you have, you know, you have Alexa, just a name, you know, you have so much automation. There's also the reliance on data. I think even more so, not just in terms of consumer data, but growing. And I'm so thrilled about this from a talent intelligence standpoint, you know, a growing need for data to be real time in terms of workforce analytics. You also have, I think, automation that is going to happen within some HR roles. And some of that's happening already with the HCM tools that are out there in the I think there's more and more adoption of those integrated HCM tools, integrating with ERPs. And so I think from an enterprise perspective, you know, we're going to have in the year 2030, our organizations are going to be run by smart. It's almost like the smartphone. You know, I think of those technologies as being a version of that, but from, you know, understanding and looking at financial implications, resourcing, talent, you know, all the talent metrics in one place. And I, in my last role at Wieden & Kennedy, this was something that I was a big proponent of, and I was really driving hard in my first year in that role, which was that we needed to get on the train right now. At that point in time, I was really driving for an integration between an HCM and an ERP. And so our systems, which is the infrastructure of running any company, are going to get smarter, more predictive of outcomes, more predictive of talent outcomes and risk, as well as business outcomes and risk. And so I really see an emergence of all of that. The underlying issue around data that I think we tend to talk about mostly from a consumer standpoint is security. And I do think that we're going to see more conversations around that in terms of privacy and security within the workplace as well. And then the next piece that I think is also changing and I'm so fascinated by this actually right now, and I haven't touched on this yet, which is this idea that HR will become more needs-based. And there are so many laws that have been put in place around equality and fairness and establishing standards in terms of making sure that one group isn't getting more than another group in the workplace. And all those things exist for all the right reasons. But I do see with these micro populations, if you think of it as independent contractors who are part of the workforce combined with a permanent staff, I do see organizations shifting the model, or at least I predict, you know, shifting the model to create value propositions, benefit packages, workplace experiences that deliver on these micro segments instead of looking at it as one whole population where everything has to hold true for every, you know, for the whole organization. And that's the aspect that I'm most curious about. We've heard the talk about gig economy, you know, people who have side hustles. You see, you know, what's going on with WeWork and sort of that co-working space. And, you know, I think all of those things are signs and signals that people want to work differently. And it's sort of like, you know, they say in real estate, whether it's a buyer's market or a seller's market, I think right now, and the shift is going to continue to go in this direction where it's a people market, right? The workforce is driving the way that workplaces need to be. And in the past, it was the opposite way. Workplaces were driving and people just complied, you know? Okay, you tell me to show up at work. This is where I work. This is my seat, that sort of thing. Now it's sort of, it's like open source kind of thing. And I'm fascinated by that. And I'm excited by that just for my own career. But as someone who is sort of a student of HR and talent management, I'm really interested in seeing where those outcomes go.
That was awesome. And one of the things that I want to dig into a little bit more, especially because my next question was going to be that since agencies reinvent themselves so quickly and so well, what can HR learn from that? And you basically touched on personalization in the sense that the same way that advertising, web marketing agencies are creating personalized experiences. So for example, someone goes to a website and they see something totally different than what somebody else would see based off of who they are, what they like, what they're into. Are you saying that HR would create that personalized experience as well from an employee standpoint? So again, depending on who you are, what you're into, what kind of lifestyle you want to live, that you'll be able to get that personalized workforce experience?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's what I have seen that happen. I should say it this way. I have seen that need emerge while I was at Wieden and Kennedy. And it was actually a conflict at a certain point where I'm like, wait a minute, you put your HR headset on, it's like, okay, I want to make sure that, you know, everyone has access to the same amount of things and that there's no preferential treatment. You know, those things lead to discrimination, right? And I'm not talking about it from that standpoint, but what I am talking about is that lifestyle choices are driving the way, the type of work people want, the way in which they want to engage in that work, and the terms in which they are willing to engage with a company to work, if that makes any bit of sense. Independent contractors, right, have completely, I mean, if you think about Uber and how that workforce is it's like the model has been completely flipped on its head. And what I see is that's a need-based thing that society, like it was the brilliant idea, Lyft and Uber, right? A brilliant idea to solve a consumer need, but yet it's created a whole different work model. And I'm seeing, or at least I predict that we will have more and more of that, which will lead to personalization, to use your word, it's exactly the right one, personalization in terms of employee experiences. I do see that HR needs to shift more to an employee experience led model, one that's integrated with the business and what a business does, and where policy takes a different form. You know, instead of policy guiding and policy being sort of, and not every company is oriented this way, but HR people, to some extent, many are oriented this way with policy leading. And I see it being completely reversed. And some agencies are well ahead of that. And I'm inspired by them. And what I hope to accomplish with the conference and with the platform that I have at the 4A's is to raise the bar. I am very passionate about creating if I think about in terms of legacy and succession planning within my field, I'm very passionate about raising a new generation of HR leaders who understand this and who are geared toward this with the right mindset, the right belief system, and the right skill set. So I'm seeing a significant shift, and my industry is kind of in the midst of it right now.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. In regards to the way that the workforce is changing and workforce business models are changing, as you gave great examples with Lyft and Uber, a lot of the jobs are also being automated or replaced either by machine learning, AI, which is artificial intelligence for all you out there who doesn't know what AI is, or just robots. And a lot of people are afraid of that. And it seems as though, back to what we were saying before, that the agency space is a very people-driven space where you're not selling widgets, you're selling ideas. Do you think, since we're talking about 2030, do you think that that's a fear that in this space, as technology and advanced analytics get smarter and smarter, that we will be able to replace even the most creative jobs and the most subjective jobs and careers with robots as well? And I'll give you a case in point. Well, the other day on LinkedIn, I saw an image of, or video rather, of somebody getting a massage from a robot. And I thought that was really interesting. And I'm thinking, wow, that's crazy. But when I thought about it, I said, wow, it's not crazy because it's a robot giving a massage. It's crazy because it's a robot putting a lot of people out of business, a person who will never have to take off, a robot that will never get sick, that you won't have to pay. Exactly. I'm in Philly. A lot of people took off yesterday for the Eagles parade.
Yeah.
You won't be taken off for that. You would just be there. And so I'm curious for the most creative positions out there, is that a fear? And do you think that that's a possibility?
You know, my God, I am not a futurist in that way, but I will say that it is a fear. I don't think that it's a fear from a creative standpoint in terms of that particular type of role and job, but certainly in other roles in an agency, infrastructure-based roles, and some of those roles that really that are more, I guess, like coordinator-like, and have more routine sets of things to go through. I think automation is good. It will hit, and that's a great thing. I think part of what my sense is, and this may be a bias just given what I do, is, you know, the emergence of technology and the ways in which we're utilizing like the Alexa type experiences and even apps. There are apps for meditation. There are apps for talk therapy. You know, there are apps for things that I never would have dreamed of and imagined. While that emergence will continue to happen and we'll be surprised and delighted by probably more than, you know, like the robot who can do a massage, which I think is hilarious. I also think that there's this inner thing in our humanity that will call, you know, that will crave human interaction more. And I might be, you know, again, I might be showing a bias because of what I do for a living, but I know in my own life and as I talk to more people, you know, some people who are creating these ideas, there's also this lost sense of intimacy. And I think as humans, just as the evolution will have it, you know, I do believe that we will crave that one-to-one, you know, voice-to-voice, looking in each other's eyes sort of connection at some point. And so I just don't know how far technology will go. And it's sort of Jetson-like. And you think of all those movies and shows from back in the day. I'm showing my age now. But, you know, and some of it you can't, you know, I can't even imagine what life would be like for, you know, in 2050, even from that perspective. But I do think that, you know, as nature would have it, you know, we are wired as human beings to, and as animals, if you think about it in that way too, we are wired for some level of human interaction. So I think there will be, as much as there will be this evolution toward more and more technology, I think that that from a humanity standpoint, we will also have this crave to be together. So that's what at least I'd hope to see, even if we have these, you know, personal assistants all around us and these robots who are doing things like cleaning and folding our clothes and all that stuff.
Got it. So the reason why I ask you, why did you choose or focus on the year 2030 is because it seems as though things are changing so fast that everyone and every company and every function is trying to be reactive in real time. So what I mean by that is, although diversity, gender pay gap, disparity, sexual harassment, let's just talk about three of the biggest societal and cultural issues that we have are really impacting HR, they weren't the talk of the town 5 years ago, although they're still really important. But now, since so many things are happening, they've really bubbled up to the top. And so my question to you is 2030 too far to look out? And should it literally be, let's just make the most important thing happen now, and then when the next thing happens, then let's just jump on that as quickly as possible? Because my fear is that, or maybe it's not a fear, but I'm just wondering, is it looking too far out where the things that we're focusing on now won't even be an issue then? We'll just have to focus on whatever's happening then in real time. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. You know, we've had some conversations at my organization recently about that. You know, there's a lot of talk about the future of work, the agency of the future. And the reality is that all of this is happening right now. It's in, it's our day-to-day, and it's a minute-by-minute thing in some cases. And so really, you know, if I were to put it in the most pragmatic way, it is change. Right. We're going through an age of disruption. It's also disruption is happening at an accelerated pace on multiple levels. I think that 5 years ago, I don't know if any one of us would have been able to really predict where we are now. I certainly had a fear you know, several years ago, that certain things were going to drive, you know, some challenges in the workplace. I knew that with the emergence of social media, for instance, that if there were behaviors that weren't supposed to take place, that, you know, there's no holding back. And so I really focused on readiness of my organization at the time. We need to be ready for these, this, this, and this. And so I think what you're saying is absolutely right. It's about changing now. The evolution has taken place. And in fact, it's more than an evolution. I think it's a revolution. And so we need to catch up and we need to advance now. And part of the conference this year is a focus on change management and organizational leadership. So there are so many elements of change that need to be put in place, and we need to organize ourselves differently. We also need to lead differently in this day and age. Social climate, social issues, social justice and injustice is calling our attention. And I think that people are looking for a level of transparency. You know, can I trust the place that I work? Can I trust the people I work with? A colleague of mine has been using this phrase or using this word a bit. It's ethics, really, right? And ethics around good business practices. What a company does for business, how they handle money, how they handle the clients they have, and also how they treat people. And some of that, we're not going to come out of this day of Me Too, Harvey Weinstein, without some significant change in the world of HR and in the world of leadership. You know, so I think you're absolutely right. 2030 is too far, and it's all about evolving right now.
Great. And then last question before we go to our final section, what are some words of wisdom or some best practices that you want to share to all of the HR professionals listening, whether they're in the advertising agency space or not, but primarily for the agency space? How can they prepare themselves, whether it's going to your conference and beyond?
The very first thing that comes to my mind is actually simple yet hard, and it's trust. I think that we have a problem in HR, and this is true of every organization, in my view, right now, because of the situations that have been called out that are happening. You know, I think the Uber post about a year and a half ago from the woman who said she had been harassed for a long time and she reported it to HR, you know, that was probably the start of some of the questioning around the HR practice itself and how good is it and what's the value of HR. I think that we as a field really need to focus on building trust, really need to focus on making our practices and our policy, I shouldn't say policy, our practices and our protocols transparent. I also think that we may need to relinquish control and ownership of some of those areas in order to take the blinders off and in order to make organizations more accountable for doing right by people. So that's my first thing is trust. My second thing would be HR, sort of in its broader sense, the human part of this is, in some organizations, HR is there for the company, right? And we've heard that, we've seen testaments of that through some of these cases. And I'm really more of the one who's always been an advocate of HR really being about the employee experience and advocating for individual sort of development, and talent management. So I think that if we can really get real about the value proposition of HR going forward, it really should be centered on employees. And by virtue of that, you sort of have this sort of middle road, right? Where you can, if you do right by your people, you're doing right by the company. And I my advice to anyone right now who's reimagining where they are as, you know, within their HR organization is to really get real about experiences that your employees have at the point of hire, at the point of being courted and sourced and sort of engaged from a recruitment standpoint, all the way through if you have employees who are retiring, you know. know, but really looking at the life cycle of an employee's experience, what we want it to be, thinking about it in the same way that you would as a marketer, the consumer journey, you know, and what does that really look like for different employee segments? So that's my other piece of advice. And my third is that I think as a field, and this is sort of my premise, and this is sort of how I've always led, is we need to be bold and brave. We need to have bigger, more audacious goals. We need to elevate the role of HR, and because I do think that we're struggling not only with an issue of trust, but also lack of respect. And some organizations, you know, will stay stuck in an operational model if we aren't able to be bold enough to lead toward a model where HR is embedded as a strategic business partner up front. And some of that may mean that some people need to change roles, quite frankly. It might mean that, you know, you have to have a difficult conversation about who's working and who's not on your team. I do think that, it's not just about a rebranding and putting new words around HR. It's about also finding the talent that can meet up and deliver on a new expectation for HR.
That was awesome. And I hope the listeners were taking notes, because you really let them learn a lot there. So last section of the podcast, which is always my favorite, is what I like to call the real, the random, and the ridiculous, where I ask you a real, a random, and a ridiculous question. Are you?
Oh my God! As if this wasn't hard enough.
Are you ready?
Okay.
So the real question, this is a very real question to me. Do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
Okay. That is hilarious. You know what? I don't mind bread pudding, but I can't say I like it. If I'm going to have a dessert, which I don't do desserts too much, but I like key lime pie. I like tarts and stuff. So bread pudding is just not on my list. Is that your favorite?
Oh, man, it is my favorite. And I should have asked you this before we did the podcast, because I don't know if you would have been a guest.
No,
this episode was awesome. That's fine. All right. You know what? We're not even going to talk about that anymore. Already broke my heart. Okay. Yeah. So the random question. Mm-hmm. You live in New York, correct?
Yes. Well, I live in New Jersey. I work in New York.
You work in New York. Okay. So this question should still be, you know, good. What's your favorite part of New York? What's your favorite neighborhood?
Oh, gosh. Wow. That's an awesome question, too. Okay. So I love Harlem. I have an aunt and uncle, great aunt and uncle, who are no longer living, but they lived in Harlem for like 40, well, actually probably 50 years. And I love the quintessential, you know, parts of Harlem that are all about the Harlem Renaissance, jazz, black artists, poets, writers, like that whole 50s vibe. I think it was like the 40s, 50s, and 60s of Harlem. So that's actually the thing that drove me to wanting to live in, move to New York when I came out of school. And so in Harlem's different now, but my favorite is part of the city is that one, because it's kind of like the legacy of African American culture, history. You know, it's like all in a bottle in Harlem. You can walk down the streets and you feel it, you know, like I said, from music to poetry, Langston Hughes to, you know, all the great jazz musicians, even in the jazz clubs that are still around and some aren't, but the Apollo Theater, you know, all of it, it just feels like it's sort of, for me, it's the essence of my identity. So
that was a great answer. And Harlem is a pretty cool neighborhood. So, ridiculous question.
Uh-huh.
What's the most ridiculous perception that you think people have of the HR role?
That we're not human, that we don't feel, you know, that we, you know, that that our jobs are easy, you know. I think that, you know, it's interesting. I think that sometimes people think that we have this automatic, you know, troubleshooting reflex, you know? But at the end of the day, we're human too. We have our own experiences as employees at the same company, you know? We also have our own growth challenges. So sometimes, you know, when I hear people say, they'll say things like, oh, I can't tell you that you're HR. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Come on, you know, or where they act different around HR, like as if we can't have fun, let our hair down. And again, you know, I guess for me, like I often think like we're human too. We like to have fun too. And we have our own problems too, you know, so.
Well, that was great. And very last question of the podcast, favorite and least favorite part of HR?
Ooh, favorite? Well, I mean, if you haven't heard this phrase from me enough, I love talent management. That's my jam, and talent management, to me is the cornerstone of what HR should be all about. Least favorite for me personally, all the payroll kind of administration, and checks and balances, you know, it's like the necessary thing. People got to get their paycheck, you know,
people have to get paid,
but for me, it's one of those areas that, should always be working, should always be dialed, but it's not my specific area of passion, you know, but it's got to get done.
Keisha, this has been an amazing episode. You have been an amazing guest. Thank you so much for joining us and dropping so many gems of wisdom.
Thank you so much, Bruce. This was a great experience.
This was so awesome. Well, I'm glad it was a great experience, especially because it was your first podcast. So now you're going to want to just be on as many podcasts as possible.
Who knows? Watch out.
So where can people find you and the 4A's online?
So you can follow hashtag 4A's Talent 2030 for the stuff around the conference. I will be keeping that hashtag alive post the conference. I am on LinkedIn, Keisha Jean-Baptiste. You can find me easily on LinkedIn. And I'm on Twitter, Keisha_KJB is where you can find me there.
Okay. And I am so thrilled and honored to be one of your moderators at the Talent 2030 conference. So please let the listeners know the date, location, and time of the conference.
All right. So the Talent 2030 conference is happening on March 6th and 7th of this year. So it's literally just under a month away. It is happening in New York City at Convene is the location. The space is called Convene. It's on 32 Old Slip, and it's a 2-day conference. We've got tremendous amount of content. We're going to cover a lot of business related areas of HR. We're going to cover a lot of people related areas of HR, and we're going to cover a lot around culture. So everything from how leaders experience feedback to disrupting the HR model to crisis management, to HR's role in mergers and acquisition, to the myth of freelancing. We've got a pretty robust agenda planned, and I am so excited to carry the legacy of this conference on from what Singleton Beato created.
Well, thanks again for all of that, and we're going to put all of that information in the show notes. Listeners, thanks again for listening to this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And if you want to continue listening to these episodes and never miss one again, download it on your favorite podcast player. So, HR folks, thanks again, and continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Later, kids.